From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. We start today with our monthly tour of top science headlines. Our guide this week on the line from London is Nature News European Bureau Chief Nisha Gaind. Nisha, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's start with some prizes called the Breakthrough Prizes. I mean, everybody knows about the Nobels. Those aren't due out for a few more weeks. What are the Breakthrough Prizes?
The Breakthrough Prizes are a relatively newly established prize. They were established in 2012 for scientific discoveries. But the thing that makes them really, really special is just the huge amount of money that comes with the prize, which is $3 million. And that's the biggest prize in terms of worth in science.
And this particular round, I mean, every round of prizes gets attention, but in particular, one winner this time, Jocelyn Bell Burnell, an astrophysicist who discovered pulsars. Why so much attention to her receiving this prize in particular?
Lots of attention on this prize, firstly, because it was a special prize. The Breakthrough Prize Committee made a decision to award her a prize outside of the normal cycle. And also because, quite controversially, Jocelyn Bell Burnell made a discovery as a student in astrophysics in the 1960s, for which her supervisor was awarded a Nobel Prize. And she is quite broadly thought to have been overlooked for that Nobel Prize.
And she has some special plans that she's already announced for how she's going to use that $3 million.
Yep, exactly. She was awarded the prize not only for her discovery, but also for her role in championing women and underrepresented groups in science. And that's what she's done in her long and very fruitful career. And that's what she will want to do with this money. She has already said that, which is a really, really brilliant thing to hear. She says that she wants to set up schemes to promote diversity in science with this money.
I mean, wonderful not only that she will be using that money and this prize to promote that, but actually that the prize committee recognized that as a contribution to the science community worthy of this award.
Exactly. That's what makes it so, so special.
All right. Moving on to South Africa, a country that has been in the news over the past several months, first for water shortages in Cape Town, more recently for a controversial land restitution plan. But Nature has been doing some reporting on the state of science in the country and how that might factor into some of these larger social challenges that the country's facing. So what's going on there?
So this is a really interesting story out of South Africa. South Africa has the strongest science system on the African continent. They have a lot more researchers. They have a lot more money. But they're trying to shift their research policy so that it really benefits the daily lives of South Africans. And that's what this big shake-up to their research policy, which is the biggest in two decades, and notably the first time it's really sort of been done after the apartheid era, that's what they're aiming to do with this change.
And what kinds of changes are they talking about?
So they're talking about making research efforts, whether they're done by government-funded scientists or by businesses who also fund research and development. They want that to translate into things that would reduce societal issues like poverty or raise unemployment or have an effect on these problems that you talked about, like drought, and not only concentrate on doing blue skies research that is less quickly translatable to the population at large.
Another trend that Nature has reported on in the past is the changing demographics of the science community in South Africa, and that soon there will actually be a black majority within the research community. How much are those kinds of changes factoring into some of these policy changes as well?
So the changing demographics of the scientific community, that's been an issue that was addressed the last time they wrote this policy, which was in the mid-90s. And it's, again, something that's been reinforced in this policy change. And actually, it has been quite successful. They have managed to shift some of that apartheid legacy to shift more black researchers and academics to have a greater proportion of those in universities.
On a different note, scientists have tested a technology for editing a human gene inside a human body. They say the first test of this. But this isn't actually the CRISPR gene editing technology that we've been hearing so much about. What is it that they're doing here?
That's right. This is a technology. It's an older technology called zinc finger nuclease. And it does a similar thing to CRISPR. It edits the gene. And what's special here is that they've done it inside the body for the first time. Usually, researchers might take cells out of patients, edit them outside the body, and then put them back in. But using this ZFN technique, this zinc finger nuclease, they've done it directly inside the body.
And in this case, it was four people with a rare disease called Hunter syndrome, and they treated with this gene therapy to essentially repair or replace a faulty enzyme that breaks down certain sugars. They say it was successful. We've heard, you know, a few times over the past decade or so about gene therapy trials that seem successful at first and then in the end maybe actually are cause for concern or at least not as successful as thought. Is there reason for skepticism here?
So the important thing to underscore is that these are very small trials. This was a trial in four people, and it is first to test the safety of this sort of technique and then to test the efficacy. It's very, very difficult to get rigorous results from four people. What they have ascertained is that it's safe and that it might be effective, but it's very difficult to interpret such a small amount of data. So the research community and obviously the public who are interested in these sorts of things are really waiting for these trials to happen in much larger amounts of people where you can ascertain an effect much more confidently.
This next story is kind of interesting because we've been hearing a lot about Google and Facebook, not necessarily in good terms recently, about problems with their algorithms, possible bias, about the problems with data privacy. But Google is now unveiling a new search engine, kind of like the Google News or Google Videos or Google Books searches that you can do. This is a Google database search. How important a tool could this be for scientists?
So this is actually a really important tool for scientists. And Google is something that we all use in our daily lives and can bear even larger for scientists because of the way that it organizes information. Scientists work with data. It's their main tool. And one of the big things is a movement called open access, or in this case, the open data movement, which is scientists making the data that they've collected open for other people to use. And what this database aims to do is if you treat your data set in the right way and you tag it in a particular way so that it's easily searchable, it opens that up to anybody who wants to search it. So it really democratizes data in a way that Google is very well known for doing.
I mean, potentially opens up the practice of science to those well outside, credentialed universities or what we would consider to be the traditional research community. Anybody could have access to these databases.
Exactly. Anybody. And even people who work in science, especially early career researchers, say that it's quite difficult to find the data that you need. You have to have quite specialized networks. You need to know people who tell you where the data is. And so this is the sort of thing that opens it up to scientists as well as anybody else who knows how to use the tool.
So one more example, perhaps, of our love-hate relationship with these platforms like Google, where we may have some misgivings, but we're getting some pretty fantastic tools out of it as well.
Exactly. And then there's the questions about what they do with that metadata, the way that the database is queried and all of that information.
Wouldn't it be great if their database was in the database search?
I think researchers would absolutely love that.
All right. Last but not least, a little bit of kind of inside baseball here. But, the peer review process is how scientific findings essentially get scrutinized prior to being published and put out into the world. A new global survey of researchers provides some insight into who is doing that review work and how much work it actually is. What are we learning from this survey?
So inside baseball, for maybe the general listener, but for scientists, this is something that just is absolutely huge. It's a really, really big part of their daily lives. Peer review is an important process because it upholds rigor, it upholds quality in scientific research. And what we're finding out is that scientists in the developed world tend to take a lot more of the peer review burden at the moment. But as scientific or pools of researchers emerge in developing countries such as China and India, which are really emerging as huge scientific forces. They're starting to do more peer review and they're starting to be introduced in those pools, but they're still doing a little bit less than their counterparts in the developed world. But this massive survey, which looked at 11,000 researchers, just gives us a big picture of who's doing this peer review, how long it takes, and how much of it they're doing.
Well, you know, it's an equity issue a little bit different from perhaps what we were talking about at the beginning with Jocelyn Bell Burnell and her Breakthrough Prize, but maybe something for her to put a little bit of time and effort into trying to equalize that system.
Exactly, yeah.
All right, that's Nisha Gand. She is European Bureau Chief for Nature. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much.